All right. So we're continuing on. Hi, Wolfram. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks a lot.
So, hey, thanks a lot for doing this with us. This has been awesome. So we're on to our next one that we're talking with people at the International Conference for Software Engineering, key computer scientists doing a whole range of science. So tell us a little bit about who we're talking to now.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm happy to be back. And this time we have another distinguished guest here with me. This is Dieter Rombach, who heads the Experimental Software Engineering Institute in Kaiserslautern in Germany.
Excellent.
And Dieter is famous for, in some sense, really championing the area of experimental software engineering. So really understanding what are the myths in software engineering and can we actually demystify some of it so that we make rational decisions based on data and not only on gut feeling.
Okay, nice.
So I thought we'll talk a little bit about what Dieter is doing and maybe a little bit his research, but maybe also his institute. And I know that he's also a big soccer fan, so we'll come
nice.
With that on.
Let's just fail.
Nice. Excellent. So
okay. So, Dieter, as far as I recall, you have actually been a professor in the U.S. a long time ago. And started together with Vic Basili the area of experimental software engineering. Maybe not everybody knows what this is. Maybe can introduce us to the field.
Yes, I was actually in the United States from 1984 to 92, and at that time I was doing research at the University of Maryland, but at the same time also applying some of the things to NASA projects at Goddard Space Flight Center. And so what we learned very early is that people applied methods, development tools to enlarge projects based on we have always done it this way or currently that's the in method and so on. And if you develop systems that have to work because once the mission is started at NASA you can't do much, you need to have some predictability. And so they wanted to know from us, I mean, given a certain project, which methods would be the best ones, which promise to guarantee the safety requirements, that you can do the project in time, etc. And at the same time, evaluate along the development line whether the product is on time, whether the quality is on target, etc. And so the only way to do this is to actually come up with data, to apply measurable criteria the same way as we would apply it in any other engineering discipline.
Okay. So Dieter, can you explain a little bit how a setup of this experiment looked like so that you can actually make reasonable judgment about, for example, different code review mechanisms or so on?
So we always started observing reality, observing real projects, what we call case studies. So for instance, when we decided to start this work, we observed big projects and said, how is effort distributed according to phases? What kinds of defects exist? Which defects enter the system in which phase? In which phase are they being detected? And then in the next step, according to the scientific principle, you think about changing the process. So for instance, you recommend using an inspection technique or a review technique. And before you actually apply it to industry, you should first convince yourself that there is a potential. And so in some controlled experiment, and that's what we call experimental software engineering actually, we evaluate this compared to existing techniques. So we compared, for instance, a new inspection technique to a checklist-based inspection to ad hoc inspection. Well, we found out that this is better than what they were doing before. We said there is a good chance this will also work in projects. There is no guarantee, but at least there is a necessary prerequisite to move it into a project. Then we convinced the people at NASA to change that process. And then we again observed what is the advantage compared to the previous baseline. And so over time, in an iterative process, you improve and improve and improve. And at some point in time, you have so much stability that you can actually predict. And today, I'm convinced to say you can predict project outcomes on a plus minus 5 to 10% accuracy. Wow. And this is compared to state of the practice, I would say, across all domains, a big improvement. And there is no, huge intellectual contribution from a technical side. It's simply accepting that the scientific principle of observing, changing, and reobserving also applies to software development.
Excellent. I mean, and isn't that really the case in most fields of engineering,
yes.
Building bridges, building buildings?
You can see that every discipline evolved by means of these cycles. Yeah, whether it's medicine, whether it's engineering, I mean civil engineering, The only difference is what you measure, what techniques you're using, but that basic principle is the same everywhere. Now, having said that, yes, there is a difference, because I always envy my colleagues in mechanical electrical engineering, because they have underlying physical laws. And so when they make predictions, they are deterministic.
Sure.
We are, I always call ours empirical or cognitive laws as opposed to physical laws. Mm. So they're always associated with some kind of uncertainty. But as I said before, 5 plus 5, 10% is pretty accurate for a design project or a design environment. We are not a production, we are a design environment. And for that, this kind of accuracy is pretty good. Yeah. Within the Fraunhofer Institute, we have achieved this with, I don't know, 20, 30 companies for certain domains. And so this is certainly repeatable.
Excellent. So since you already just talked about the Fraunhofer Institute, let us understand. So ICSI really tries to reach academics and, in some sense, connect them to practitioners. And I understand that the Fraunhofer Institute in Germany is exactly for that, built for that purpose, in some sense, to bridge.
It's actually a bridge, and it's a unique setup in Germany that between academia and industry we have that bridge. So our mission is actually to take inventions, to describe it simply, from academic research and make it practically usable. And there is a huge gap between those two. Very often academics think, having a solution, why doesn't industry use it? There's a big gap. And we are bridging this gap by means of applied research. And an essential part of the applied research is this empirical evaluation. Mm-hmm. So practitioners to whom we offer techniques, the risk compared to just getting the naked technology, getting the technology with empirical evidence, is reduced to a point that you can seriously consider taking that risk. I learned this personally because when I was at University of Maryland and project manager at NASA, I had to decide whether I use my own ideas on my projects. And I found out very quickly that if your success is measured in doing a successful project, you don't want to be a guinea pig. Mm-hmm. So you want from those people some pre-work, that they convince you. And as we do in all other areas, if something new comes around, you first test it in the lab before you move it into practice. And I think that's, to me, in the meantime, I would say not everybody claiming it to be a software engineer is a software engineer according to my definition. A software engineer means you provide technology methods with some evidence. If you are just providing a language, you are a language person. That's fine. That's nothing worse than software engineer. It's different. Because engineering requires, what's the question of an engineer? I have a problem, I have a context, and I want a solution for this problem in this context. So in software engineering, the same. I have a project, it might be safety critical, it might be security relevant, tell me how to do this. Mm-hmm. So we need to work towards handbooks or laws that say, for what kind of domain, what kind of requirements do which methods work?
So do you think it's all education, or could we actually even imagine building something in Eclipse or Visual Studio that we can incorporate the tools in some sense of those insights?
I believe we should not develop any tools anymore without having measurability.
Yeah.
Provide the data, because very often that is what is inhibiting progress, because it's too expensive. You might have a plan what to measure, but you actually get the data.
Yeah.
It's so expensive that people shy away from it. Mm-hmm. So the same as I said, software engineering means results with evidence. I think on the tool side, we shouldn't provide tools without measuring whatever the characteristics of that tool are.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So another question that comes to my mind is that in your experimental software engineering, you have looked at many myths of what's the best review technique. One thing that I think is currently really booming is version control systems, right? And we see that in some sense different companies have very different attitudes. Oh, you should have lots of branches in order to allow concurrent work. But then you have problems that it takes a long time that version can be checked in before it's in main, or do very few branches. So do you know of any work in the empirical software engineering domain that goes on that addresses it? And what are the pressing questions for empirical software engineering, like maybe the branch analytics?
Actually, this is not an area of expertise of mine, so I don't know about the detailed studies. But I'm a strong believer that version control must not be considered in isolation. Because to me, it's all about control of a project and product. And based on my experience, there is always a trade-off between control at the product level, which we typically refer to when we talk about version or configuration control, and control at the process level. So you have the two extremes. You have very product-oriented developments where all the control is on the shoulders of the version control or configuration control system. You have, especially in my area of embedded systems, lots of very rigorous processes where the version control is not as complicated. Yeah? And so in reality, you always balance the two between process control and version or product control, let me call it this way, to have the two words. Yeah?
Yeah.
And from my point of view, is basically, if I look at this, which is the best combination for a product to achieve the desired quality, to achieve the, that could be maintainability, the desired cost of development, and so on. So the driver is not, I mean, a version control system and a process are means towards an end.
Yeah.
So the effects I would measure, which one allows me to build systems or families of systems in shorter time, or which allows me to be more effective quality cost-wise in terms of maintenance.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned...
Actually, today's keynote, where someone talked about we can't compare skis and running shoes the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, this is similar. It depends what you evaluate. And I might pitch here, that's actually the reason why Vic and I invented GQM. That we said, before you run an experiment, you should really know what you want to know.
Can you shortly explain GQM?
GQM is basically, as I said, don't think about which data should I collect, but first think, what do you want to achieve? So, for instance, if you want to achieve that you can compare different inspection techniques with respect to what? Whom do you want to provide this information, an inspector or a manager? They might have different models. And so once you know all these constraints, what you want to do with it, then you can actually decide which data are useful. And I always do it, if I then select the data, I give artificial data to those people and say, interpret them. If they can't interpret them, I will not waste time in collecting data. Yeah, because it's a very hard thing to collect these data, especially if they're not just product related. And you can't tell people every 2 weeks collect different data. And so the GQM allows you to define the data you have to collect, but at the same time it allows you a kind of prototype interpretation game that if people can't even interpret those data, don't start wasting their time in collecting data. They will only be frustrated.
Yeah.
We are basically, I always say, with GQM, you can avoid data cemeteries.
So Microsoft collects a lot of data, and what we see right now is that we really, in some sense, apply empirical software engineering or software development analytics to make recommendation systems, to make predictions, to make alert systems, and so on. So I think this area is, in some sense, really growing in importance right now because of the amount of data that we are collecting for our processes.
I think this is exactly the right approach Microsoft is going in this direction, because there is a tremendous value in those data that characterizes everything, the entire culture, everything of the organization. And very often, if we don't analyze them by means of data mining, by means of code, there's different approaches to do this. And then to take action to improve, I mean, it's a waste. I always say, don't run a project without trying to learn something. As a measurement person, that means you have to collect some information and learn something from that. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Where else do we want to learn from? People who do astrophysics watch the stars. Yeah? Mm-hmm. If we want to learn, the only thing we can watch is products and projects we are running. Where else do we want to learn from?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Very
so the point is also in our field, you can't do this in an academic environment.
Mm.
Because the real project data are in industry. So how do you establish a relationship that works?
Mm-hmm.
This was the reason for NASA at the time for me, and now Fraunhofer in Germany. Because I can't go to Microsoft and say, oh, by the way, can you give me for tomorrow some data? No, we have to establish a long-term relationship, because that requires trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so Fraunhofer is one approach to establish long-term collaborations with companies.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we have the advantage of getting data. And they have the advantage of getting interpretations back that might help them making important decisions.
Interesting. So now in the case of, say you mentioned Microsoft, for example, so we'll use that as an example. If you look at what they do for NASA, which are sort of these not general purpose things that they're shooting up to Mars to do, you know, specific things that they can't really touch in again. So it's embedded, it makes sense, it's very confined. But if you have a general purpose, say, operating system that you aren't necessarily sure how people are going to abuse it and use it.
So
much how does this work?
You just have different goals. I mean, it's harder to anticipate what's right, what's wrong. It starts already when you develop these systems, requirements engineering. Requirements engineering is a pretty straightforward thing when you talk about a satellite. But here I have to get either input from your marketing people or I have to be able to talk to different customers. But it's a much more complex process in that world. And I think that's also the reason why you have so many data. NASA knew exactly, I mean, kind of what 10, 15 or 20 data points they needed. You have so much data, not only for about your systems, but also feedback from your customers. So I would say it's more complex, but still, start small and increase. I always believe, ask the top five questions. I go to people in organizations, to developers, to managers, to corporate people and say, what would be the three things, if I would be a fairy, you would like to know? And if you can start with those showing contributions, then follow-up questions will come. And very important it is also that you can show the relationship between things you do at the development level, product level, the strategic level, and so on. That's, by the way, one of the big problems most software development organizations in large companies do have. That is very often not clear. What does it mean, what those people down there do? But the only way to do this is actually measuring it from different points of view and showing the relationship and show what the impact is. We have just developed something that's called, we mentioned GQM, GQM plus strategies. It's a very simple thing. It says, it's not sufficient that we tell you what to measure with GQM or allow someone else. We have to get a trace throughout the organization. What is the key process measurement at the corporate level? What strategies do you employ? What is the measurement at the next level, all the way down to software? And that actually is an important thing, not only to have control, but also show the impact of software to the overall strategic goals of a corporation.
Excellent.
So maybe that leads then to, in some sense, your current work on empirical software engineering for embedded systems.
Yes.
So what's the main challenge of developing embedded systems, and why is it different from, let's say, general purpose business systems?
I wouldn't say it's in general different. The difference is in many information systems, you are happy if you say, I do it as good as possible.
Yeah.
In embedded systems, there is a clear quality of service level. If you can't get certified for that, it's not there. You can't provide. Because very often these things have safety critical implications. And in order to do these guarantees, you have to have a clear understanding also of the system. We have learned the hard way that you can't do software engineering for embedded systems without having system engineers. We focus on software, yes, but you have to really understand the system. And we are now observing two incredible challenges in our field. The first one is actually that we get more and more, and you may want to use the term cyber-physical system, some people call it open embedded systems, where embedded nodes and information systems node get together to provide higher level services. And the problem here is that suddenly you do not only have small components which are safety critical, which you might get right by just working 6 weekends, day and night, but they are huge. I started in the automotive industry, we had about 60,000 lines of code in 3-4 different devices. Today we have 30 million. And not only control software, it's also other software, but because they're interconnected, everything is potentially safety critical. Security problems can cause safety problems. These are challenges. Nobody at this point in time knows how to certify 30 million lines of code for safety. But we're doing it. And at the same time as we're trying to approach that problem, we are starting the next one by means of what you call sensors and so on. I always call it software that can see and hear. We allow systems to adapt during runtime. So we were just able, I think software engineering was ready to guarantee quality of service in static systems of a certain complexity. So first we make it complex by integrating safety and security related systems, embedded and information systems. At the same time, we say, and they can change during runtime. So how do you do this? How can you assure that the system that's taking on configurations you have never envisioned, that you can provide service, quality of service guarantee? Our current approach is in the context of product lines, we only allow changes in a predefined way. So like you would say during design time, you have a product line where you can create certain variants but not others. The same way as we say, during runtime, you can switch between those predefined ones. Mm. But that's not what Ubiquitous is all about. Ubiquitous really means you can create versions or configurations that you have never anticipated before.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how far we can get where that's applicable to embedded systems. Mm-hmm. But if it's not applicable to embedded systems, it will not be applicable to other systems, because more and more the world merges between embedded and information system. You know, we work with a big company, John Deere, in the commercial vehicle field. And they plan on not selling devices, mowing machines, whatever it is in the future. Mm-hmm. They want a smart farm management systems, mm-hmm. which means everything interconnected. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so what does it now mean being safety relevant? Everything, every wrong information. In a hospital, mm-hmm. you're taking, the doctor exams him and decides how the MRI should work. Now, if that's all interconnected, if you have a security problem, he can get killed under this machine. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're moving more into a more world where these different cultures, which before hardly talked to each other, are merging. Mm-hmm. And this is not a trivial development. We are already doing these systems. Right now, we are staying careful because mostly we don't allow them to take actions. For instance, in the medical world, you can't get certified right now if taken action. You can only recommend to the patient or doctor something. So there is a safeguarding built in. But when you look in terms of autonomous driving,
yes,
we have them on the commercial vehicle side. We have today with John Deere devices that can mow or harvest a vineyard automatically. Mm-hmm. Because off-road, it's okay. If you kill a grape, it's okay. But on-road, it's not possible. Now, the problem is some of these devices can't even now drive to the field. You have to have a truck to drive them there because of the autonomous capability. They're not allowed certified to drive on the road. So you can see what I'm trying to say is we're building these systems, but we need to understand for what kinds of quality of services can we allow that flexibility or this intelligence. Everybody wants to provide it because who doesn't want to create intelligent systems? But it drives terrible challenges. But that's not unusual in our field. When I started, we couldn't even build systems right, which were static.
Yeah.
The application's always a runaway, which is not unusual when you heard also this morning that software is no longer, software is not just a field. We drive almost every business process, everything with software.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? Absolutely.
And so that's also why I'm so excited about this field, because it's never boring. Before we have finished things, I mean, it's like in version control. Yeah. You are changing something, and someone else is changing already the requirements for what you're changing. That's the field, the situation we are always in.
Now, what about, you know, since the cloud computing is now the huge thing, I mean, that must keep you up at night, huh, when you have these distributed services communicating over non-standard protocols.
I'm a little bit nervous always with the new buzzwords.
Okay.
Cloud is another one. I think it's important, but the main concept of virtualization mm-hmm. is not new.
Sure.
Now everybody does it. But there is still, I mean, nobody knows how to use this. I mean, the same other buzzword in embedded is multi-core. Yeah? Mm-hmm. We know we have these things, but nobody knows how to program them. But everybody does now multi-core, everybody does cloud. I believe that the concepts are very promising. Mm-hmm. Yeah? But this, from my point of view, is another target of empirical studies. Mm-hmm. We don't know how to program things, what's more effective. We don't know how you should configure a cloud, both from a user as well as a provider point of view. Mm. And so we are basically right now doing trial and error approaches. And I think systematic, scientific it is if we understand which version to use or what form to use for what kind of application. So every new buzzword actually makes me happy because it establishes a new department in my institute for empirical studies.
Perfect.
Okay, I think that gives a very nice overview of your work in the past, but some people know you in some sense, maybe also in form of another role. I know that you're very involved in soccer, so maybe we can wrap up the interview by saying, what actually excites you beyond the normal computer science stuff?
I mean, I should say, we just talked about that certain things are unpredictable in our field, but I wanted to have a a third job besides university in Fraunhofer, that's even less predictable. Oh. And so I'm a soccer fan for many years. Oh. So now I decided to accept the challenge to be the chairman of the board of a German professional Bundesliga club.
Wow.
And we took it over when it was almost in the third league, and now it's in the first league, number 7, actually a big success.
Nice.
But I can tell you, in my field of research, I know reasonably well when I did good work, which might be promising or not. Mm. In this field, if the guys don't score, everything was bad. The same work, if they score, everything was good. Yeah. So if you ever want to be in a non-predictable environment, mm. I invite you to join this the field of sports, professional sports.
But on the other hand, what you just said is actually sounds good for computer science because it's either 1 or 0, right?
Yes. So
it's
but actually, we are already doing now some projects with IT because, I mean, a soccer, in the kind of medical treatment, in the kind of tactics, exploration of replaying situations and so on, mm-hmm. Entire IT infrastructure, they are basically mid-sized companies, at least mid-sized companies. Mm-hmm. So we also use this a little bit as a nice environment to test some of our ideas. Mm-hmm. So we are developing technology where with means of sensors you can decide whether a ball is behind the goal or not,
yes.
line and so on. Unfortunately, the executives at FIFA are a little bit too old. They're in the 90s. Mm-hmm. They don't quite get it yet, but eventually it will happen. The technology even enters the field of sports.
So,
soccer,
so
I should say.
In soccer, in some sense, because it is an organized, so it might be analog, but it's organized.
Should be organized. if you have the right players.
That's what I was going to say. So you're the algorithm would be just get messy, get all the best players you can, put them... I mean, isn't that what you really try to do?
Fit together, yeah. You
exactly.
have to have a strategy, and you have to fit a strategy to your players, or vice versa, and that's success, yeah. That's actually the nice thing. We had a very successful year because we were successful in that game, mm-hmm. and so as the team with the lowest budget by far mm-hmm. in Bundesliga of 18 teams, we ended up number 7,
cool.
which was really a big surprise in Germany.
Congratulations. Right on. Hey, great to meet you.
Wonderful. I think that is a great opportunity to wrap up. Thanks, Dieter. I think it was very insightful to hear what goes on in empirical software engineering and in embedded systems and in soccer.
And next time you come to Germany, I do not only invite you to Fraunhofer or university, I also invite you to a game.
Okay, I love that.
Yes.
Excellent.
Okay,
perfect.
Thanks a lot, everyone, and hope to see you soon.
Yes, thank you, Wolfram.